You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 7th of June 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live at RadioAryan.com because tonight we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door and the Freemasonic Victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise, on the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. Mr. Dennis Wise, how are you today, good sir?
Well, that was a nice introduction. You forgot to mention "and the man with no channels on YouTube."
Yes,
About to give up with that. There, you know, I mean, very put a lot of work into put a video up, and some monkey comes along and takes it off, calls it hate speech. So, you know,
if it's any consolation, it's not just you, is it? I think there's about 100 odd channels that have gone. I mean, lots of people. You know, it's so, you know, people put so much work into producing content like that. You know, they put all their effort into producing these videos. People like the videos. That's why they subscribe to the channel. The channel becomes popular and then they just get rid of it with no thought at all for, you know, the feelings of the people, to be honest, that have put all their heart and soul into doing that work. And also all the people that enjoy watching it, enjoy listening to it. I mean, what do they hope to achieve with this? They just infuriate the listeners and the viewers. They get really angry at YouTube and angry at the government and the pressure groups that cause this. And the people that make the content, they just double down. And they set up another channel or they go to another company. But people don't stop thinking the way they do because of this. You know, people just get more certain and adamant that, yes, we must fight this. You know, it's harsh.
The thing is, it's owned by Google. And I'm no great lover of Google because out of all the, you know, the browsers, they're the ones that do the most tracking. They're the ones who, you know, break the laws to get what they want. And they're that rich. I mean, they lost 400 million one day and they didn't even glitch. You know, so, you know, I've been full of YouTube. I really have.
I did hear that there was, it might even have been billions. I think it was hundreds of millions that was wiped off the price, the share price of YouTube.
Really?
When they started doing the censorship last year, it was on one of those gaming sites that looks at the way political correctness interferes with the computer games, and they released this information on it. So they are losing money by doing this, and all it does is, you know, it doesn't radicalize people, but it does make them, you know, all the more determined to beat them, and it just makes people angry at YouTube.
Well, yeah, I think it proves us right as well. You know, they don't take it off, you know, without a reason, and I think the amount of videos they've taken off over the years. I've alerted a lot of people, shall I say, and it's not something they wanted, and so they've took this drastic action of just wiping everybody off.
No, it's a credit, isn't it, really? It's a credit.
I think so,
people.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, it just encourages competition. If they hadn't done this, there wouldn't be BitChute. And there's BitChute now, and that's gaining traction, gaining ground all the time. I think, who was it the other day, someone hit 10,000 subscribers on there? Or it may have been 100,000 subscribers. I think it was Sargon.
50,000, I've heard. One.
Yeah, it's gradually building up as, you know, as a competition for YouTube. And they tried to do away with that by trying to get them banned from PayPal or whatever, which is, you know, it's really dirty tricks, isn't it? It's like, well, we're not going to allow any competition at all, and we'll play any dirty tricks we can to get rid of them. And it's the same with the mainstream media. When they say that we're making hate speech or whatever, we must be taken down, it's because we're competition for them. You know, a lot of the alternative sites, they get more views than ever BBC or CNN or any of them get. YouTube has massive figures. And it's actual competition. It's I forget what the word is, but it's when companies have a monopoly, and they conspire to keep out anybody else from producing any competition. And that goes right against all the principles that they say capitalism is built on. You know, this wonderful system that we're supposed to have. Great system that they've all been celebrating this week that they brought in at the end of the war. And they got rid of the nasty Nazis and brought in the new liberal order that we're all supposed to be so happy under.
And then no more wars.
Yeah, no more wars. We'll forget about Iraq and Libya and Syria and South America.
All the rest.
All the regime change. Yeah, well, I guess you must have seen it this week, Dennis, on the news there, the D-Day celebrations and Donald Trump and the rest of them.
Yeah, well, I saw the interview with Trump. It wasn't really much, really. I mean, I didn't really pay much attention to it because I've always felt that D-J, I mean, before I came on tonight, I looked up some figures and people still can't find the total amount what were killed, and I believe what was quoted was ridiculously low. So there's a lot been hidden, I think.
Well, we know how many Jews were killed, don't we? We're certain of that one, 6 million, no less.
Well, that's just an estimate.
That's the only number we do know, isn't it? No, nobody has an idea how many British people were killed in the war, how many French, how many German, but by law, in 27 countries in the European Union, you have to say it was 6 million Jews that died. Very, very strange.
Yeah, and even that, you know, I mean, Auschwitz changed its figures a few times, hasn't it? So even that's not correct, but it's politically correct, and that's what matters these days, I think.
Well, one thing that did stick in my mind was Theresa May, as she appeared to be playing a part in a school play or something. She was sort of stood there on a stage and reading from a script. And it was as if she was in a school play. And then they had, I'm not joking, seriously. And then they had, they did actually have a play. And I think this was in Portsmouth there. And they had a big celebration for D-Day and what have you. But the problem was all the poor people from Portsmouth, they couldn't see it because it was all fenced off and walled off with all security to keep Donald Trump and the rest of them safe. So they weren't very happy because they'd been told they were going to have these big celebrations. It's all just for the cameras, really, isn't it?
The thing is, Trump was talking to Piers Morgan last night, and for the first time ever, believe it or not, I thought I was listening to an elite. I've never thought that before about Trump. I mean, I don't particularly like the guy and his views on Israel, but I've never thought of him. He always talked like one of us, but for the first time ever, he was kind of answering like an elite, and that was very strange to me.
It seems, you know, he's changed since he got in there, obviously. I mean, he hasn't kept his main promise, which was about that wall, and you can sort of... You can say, well, the problem is he's just one man. And if he's going to replace all the people in there, he needs people that he's going to replace them with. And who's he going to get that isn't corrupt to replace the people that are in the banks, replace the people that are responsible for the security services? There's nobody that he can go and pick that isn't just as corrupt as the people that he wants to kick out. That's the problem. That's the problem. And I think also he thinks Jews are white. And he sees no distinction
can't
between them.
Join them. That's what seems to them.
I think he sees them as a part of Europe. So he standing up for the Jews, he thinks he's standing up for Europeans. He's standing up for Judeo-Christianity, which he thinks is everything is built upon. I do think he has integrity. I don't think he's sort of deceiving everybody by doing this.
There's some things I like about him, but other things, I've got to say, I don't go there. But he does what he does. He's got where he is, and it could have been. I think it could have been worse for her anyway.
I don't think he's going to be sort of shocking the world with World War II truth anytime soon. But at least
we've shocked the world with World War III. We around.
Yeah. Well, at least we've got you there to expose the truth about World War II, Dennis, and about about D-Day.
The thing is, like I said, it's the figures what I've always been annoyed at. And plus we've got this other story what I came across, which I'm sure you're going to go into.
Yeah, this is the first I'd actually heard this, and you sent me this link the other day.
That's right.
I'm surprised there wasn't more made of it, because this was hidden for a long time, apparently.
40 years they hid it, I think.
40 years. 40 years. Some of our listeners might be aware of it, but they actually had a practice for D-Day about a month before it actually happened. 75 years ago, the Allies launched a massive dress rehearsal for the invasion of Normandy, the famous D-Day landings that would happen 5 weeks later. but that rehearsal turned into one of the war's biggest fiascos. It took place on Slapton Sands, a beach in southwestern England. British historian Giles Milton wrote about the rehearsal on his blog. The beaches there are long and they are wide, so it gave the soldiers plenty of opportunity to really experience what it was going to be like, Milton tells us. The beaches in the west of England are almost identical to the beaches in Normandy. The rehearsal was given the code name Operation Tiger. The plan, to get landing boats into the English Channel, then have them simulate a water landing on the beaches of the Devon coast. The man in charge was the great Allied commander Dwight D. Eisenhower. He wanted to put them out in the rough waters of the channels, have them shaken around, exposed to seasickness, everything else that soldiers are prone to, Milton says. Then the idea was for these ships and tank landing craft involved in this operation to bring them up towards Slapton Sands, where there was going to be shell fire and gunfire so the men would land in real battlefield conditions. But to ensure the safety of their men and the effectiveness of the whole exercise, Allied command had to keep the operation a secret, even from their own men. So this is all top secret, but the lack of Germans on the shore belied a German presence on the water. A German patrol fleet is out in the English Channel, Milton explains, and quite by chance it picks up on its radar this enormous flotilla of vessels and dramatically and suddenly launches attacks on some of the easy pickings of the flotilla. The torpedoes tear into these vessels and literally blow them apart, Milton says. They all catch fire and there's complete carnage, pandemonium, men on fire, tanks on fire, the ships on fire, and of course the ships starting to sink. Allied commanders, monitoring from London, ordered all the boats to scatter immediately, hoping to avoid any more direct hits from the Germans. But the order left hundreds of men floating in the icy waters. And that's just typical of them, really, isn't it? Just, oh yeah, just leave. Leave all your men there to die in the waters. And we have a chap called Gerolstein, who was a gunner's mate, second class, on a tank landing ship called LST-515. His commanding officer refused the order and turned his boat back, directing his men to rescue their compatriots still in the water. "We put cargo nets over the side," Gerolstein recalled. "I went down the cargo net to the last hole. I put my leg through one hole and my arm through another one. And as the men in the water came by, we'd grab them and pull them up onto the net and they could work their way up." All told, Gerolstein and the rest of the LST-515 crew managed to save 70 or 80 lives. Later, he recalled seeing the scene clearly for the first time as the sun rose over the water. "When we got back and then the light broke, you could walk across the dead bodies in the water," he said. "There were over 700 of them that were killed." And that's really shockingly bad planning there, sending this flotilla out where you know indeed there's likely to be German ships, and they get sunk, and instead of staying there to pick them up, they just all disappeared. They were told to get out of the way. Didn't something similar to this happen when the Lusitania went down? They were unable to be rescued for some reason. The people
it happened a couple of times, hadn't it? I think it was just two U-boats, you know, just casually passing by. Well, I was casually, but they couldn't believe their eyes when they saw what was happening.
Yeah, a huge flotilla, massive target. Exactly. Massive target. And
It's a duck hunt, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 700 of them dead. So you think, well, that's really bad, that is. But no, it gets even worse.
Gets worse.
Yeah. Yet the carnage wasn't yet over. Many of the ships continued on towards the beach at Slapton Sands. Eisenhower had ordered live fire to be used in the rehearsal because he had wanted to simulate real-world conditions. Now, the idea was that the shelling would stop very, very shortly before the American soldiers came on shore, so that the wreckage of war would still be around, Milton said. The smells of war, the sounds, the shell-blasted beach would be there, but there was a terrible mix-up of timings, which meant that as the American soldiers came onto the shore, the British were still shelling the beach. This meant the Americans came under devastating friendly fire from the British. Within minutes, 300 more American troops were dead. Gerolstein helped ferry some of the wounded to the hospital. The orders were, in the hospital, you will not ask these men anything, he says. You will not ask them anything, you will just take care of them. When the whole affair was over, close to 1,000 American troops were dead. It's a staggering figure, Milton says. All the more staggering when you realise that more people were killed in the rehearsal for the landing at Utah Beach than were killed in the actual landing at Utah Beach. And Utah Beach was one of the beaches in Normandy that Allied troops charged on D-Day. For nearly 40 years, well after the end of the war, Operation Tiger remained a secret. Allied command did not want the bulk of the troops about to risk their lives going over to Normandy knowing that this disaster had unfolded in the west of England, Milton replies. Today, on the beaches of Slapton Sands, there remains a small memorial to the 946 men who lost their lives that April day 75 years ago. Now, I'm just thinking there, Dennis, the British that were on the beaches, they had live ammunition firing at the Americans. I doubt whether these Americans had any live ammunition. So they would have been sitting ducks when the Germans shot at them, wouldn't they? They couldn't have fired back.
Well, like I said, I've got doubts over the official figures anyway, because there was no machine gun fire on that beach. And they haven't got any bunkers, machine gun bunkers to overtake. It was simply the shelling and the men lost at sea. And, you know, to me, to say there were less killed or more killed there than in the real landing, I can't believe that. I really can't.
Well, they say more, yeah. 1,000, they say, were killed during this rehearsal, and they're saying that was more than on the Utah beach. I think they would have had machine gun posts on the British beach there. They would have had. They would have tried to make it as close to what it was going to be like in France as possible, only they weren't expecting the American boats to be so close to the shore that they were going to get hit by it. I mean, that's just an accident waiting to happen, isn't it, really?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think it would have been hours, but...
That's crazy.
When I was doing it for The Greatest Story, I looked into it, and there was a YouTube video of just one German who apparently had killed 1,000 soldiers himself, and he went on to be good friends with this American today. And I can well believe it, because if you've got 150,000 troops all landing on a certain five beaches or a 50-mile stretch, and you've got machine guns waiting for them, there's going to be some casualties. And I don't mean little casualties. There's going to be a mass of casualties.
Oh, it must have been. Must have been huge casualties. And it wouldn't surprise me if they did cover that up. I think they missed their objective for the first day or two. Because they were expecting to secure, I think, all five of those beaches, and they hadn't secured any of them by the end of the first day, is what I've been reading.
Well, that's different from what I've just read, I think. They were claiming they had them, but then again, you know, they can claim a lot of things, especially when they won the war.
Well, it may have been the five cities or the five targets. They had five targets they were expecting to get within the first day, I think, and they failed.
Yeah.
So they must have, you know, the French must have put up a good fight.
Do you know for sure if they had air cover? Because any film I've seen, I can't remember any air cover.
I think they turned up at night, didn't they? It was a moonlit night. I don't know if they had air cover. Probably. But then they would have heard them coming. They would have heard them coming more, I would have thought.
It's a strange one.
But just the fact that they actually did come and invade France, I think that was illegal. Because France was under an armistice with Germany, and, you know, Northern Ireland is under an armistice with Ireland at the moment, and the agreement is that the hostilities cease and you have a government there and everything goes on as normal. And anybody that breaks that peace is a terrorist. So France had come to a peace, and, you know, they had a legitimate government there, and then suddenly you've got Britain and America invading the country and calling it a liberation.
Yeah, I don't think the French were too keen on
no.
The fact that they should go through another war again.
Yeah, well, I think there was more destroyed during the liberation than there was, you know, in the first instance when Germany made its way to the beaches. because they didn't want to destroy things. And they didn't, you know, rape the French women, which is what went on. Lots of rapes. But the thing is, I mean, the French really weren't very happy with Britain either. But you remember we discussed it a while back about the French fleet, and that was just bombed by Winston Churchill. They had an agreement that the Germans wouldn't use this fleet. And if they did try to use it, the captains had orders to turn the guns on the Germans. And Churchill just ignored that and destroyed this French fleet with all the French naval men on board. So they weren't looking to Britain to save them. They were angry at Britain for killing off their French navy. And they had peace there. As we discussed before, they got rid of the Rothschilds Bank. They got rid of the Freemasons. They made that film. Dark Forces.
I mean, compared to today with the invasion of Africans, it was a wonderful place to be.
And they didn't have armed soldiers on the streets like they do now.
No.
It's made out to be such a heroic thing, this resistance. And when they were just terrorists, the French resistance that they lionize in Hello, Hello, and they make them out to be really great people, they were nasty communist terrorists that would just kill people, that were breaking the peace when there was a legal armistice. And everything about World War II, when you look into it, it's the opposite of what we're actually told.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you control the press. And they certainly didn't let anything out of Europe what they didn't want people to know. They only let out, you know, what they wanted them to know, if you know what I mean.
It was all hidden, but, you know, I just think, you know, it's just amazing that so much of it, it's not a little bit of it. It's not, you know, the odd bit here and the odd bit there that we've been lied to about it. It's the whole war, everything to do with it.
Well, the thing is with lies, I mean, More than even lies, they don't tell you about what went on. They'll just bury it. And by burying it, that extends the lies. Because if you knew what had gone on, you could see the lies straight away, if you know what I mean. So that's the intention. They'll just bury it and then lie and hope that that lie then lasts enough generations for it not to matter.
Well, it just shows you that, you know, if they had to lie about every part of it, then there was actually very little that people would disagree with what the Germans were doing.
Knew. there was probably told that the Germans were wreaking havoc. You know, I'm quite sure, you know, the American soldiers were fired up thinking that, you know, they're going to face a monster now. Where in reality, if you'd have gone over to France, you'd have probably found the country more settled than it is today.
Well, we know that they must have been really fired up because of the horrible things that they did to the Germans when they found them. You know, what they did to the SS, you know, the SS would surrender their weapons and expect to be treated with the same amount of decency that they'd been treating the British soldiers just shot against the wall.
Told them a different story.
Yeah. Yeah. All made out to be heroes today. I see these ancient British veterans, and I do think they, you know, they must have been lied to, because you know they're decent people. They were fighting for their country. They thought they were doing the decent thing, and the people that could have spoken up and said, "Well, hang on, you know, this isn't quite right. What you're being told." They locked all of them up under Regulation 18B. They were all put in prison. Oswald Mosley and all of them, all locked up.
Well, I covered this again in the second documentary, Communism by the Back Door, where I discovered I think it was the Omaha Beach, I think. There's a memorial for the Americans what were killed there, and plenty of crosses, you know, on the graves. But it's next to a lake which reflects these buildings, which it looks very much like a Masonic graveyard, if you like. And then right on the wall there is the pyramid with the eye over the top looking over the soldiers, and immediately I'm thinking they've died for communism. That's exactly what, and when I looked into it, that's exactly what they did, because obviously Stalin was fighting in the east, and these people landed thinking we're going to kill this monster, when the real monster was coming from the east and allied to these Masonic leaders. So it was a complete I don't know. Con job big enough?
Well, they play down the repression of Freemasonry, don't they? You don't often hear
quite
about
so,
that.
Yeah.
You don't often hear about that, and yet that was far more important than you would think, because of you know the amount of power that Freemasonry has, and you say that it's up there on a par with the Jews for you know control of governments and being involved in everything, and Hitler was removing them as well. So you've got the two biggest power bases in the world, basically Jews and Freemasonry, that he was removing, and they just couldn't stand for that.
I think it's a question of two religions as well, because there's no doubt. I mean, they deny it, but there's no doubt that Freemasonry is a religion. I mean, they have, you know, different words for heaven. They have altars of Solomon in every entrance. You know, they got their own Bible. They're certainly a religion. But I think that World War II was the religion of the dark against the real light, and the dark did win.
Well, it's a Gnostic religion, isn't it? It's about you know, man becoming like God, man making his own laws, obeying his own laws. And you can contrast that with Christianity, which in the more spiritual aspects of it had asceticism, which was rejecting all the material possessions. So you know, to real extremes, you would get, you know, people that made their own dwellings, lived off the land, didn't eat meat, or they'd only eat meat once a year or whatever. They'd flagellate themselves, they'd whip themselves, they'd stand in frozen lakes reciting the Psalms and reciting them prayers. You know, they would reject all the material possessions, whereas with Freemasonry, it's all sort of built around business, and you know, whoever is the most wealthy can get up the highest up the rungs of the ladder and, you know, do the most degrees and become a worshipful master or whatever the names is at the top there. It's like the opposite of the Christian religion, but it is similar. As you say, it has all the trappings of a religion whilst claiming not to be a religion. And at the same time, they say, well, it doesn't matter what God you follow, so long as you follow a God. And just that in itself is saying, well, there isn't one God. There isn't one truth.
Yeah, there's no one true God, yeah.
Yeah, they're saying there's no one truth. Truth can be changed. There's no universal truth, because you can't have, you know, more than one God, basically, because then there's no God, is there? You know, a God of all.
This is what they say. Well, they say you have to believe in a higher element or a higher God, if you like. But the way they do it, they accept anybody and everybody, which eliminates the belief of the people joining. But what it does do, it entraps them into the belief of what it really is about, and that is, to me, it's a Luciferian religion.
Well, anything that sets man up above God is satanic, isn't it? It's about the reversal of things. And this, then it's all couched in flowery language, isn't it? Liberty, equality, the brotherhood of man, all this sort of stuff. Equality, basically. And what is equality? So like, male is the same as female, good is the same as evil, blurring the boundaries. What are the boundaries? Well, they are the borders of the countries, and having a new world order, which is run by an elite, and an elite of people that have worked their way through these Freemasonic degrees and decide on their own laws without looking to divine revelation for these laws from the past, from Christianity, from our traditions. So it's setting man up as being above God, basically. And it's saying, well, we can create our own God. We can be our own God. You know, humanism and the Enlightenment and these Enlightenment values, they all come from Freemasonic ideology, which all came from the Kabbalah in the first place. It was all like Jewish magic and making it for Gentiles. And in exchange for giving that Jewish magic to the Gentiles in Freemasonry were expected to advocate for the Jews. So they were like Jewish finger puppets. So they could advocate for civil rights for the Jews in the French Revolution. and end up emancipating the Jews and saying, well, you know, let's let the Jews come into government, let's let them buy businesses, let's let them do everything else that everybody else does and give them the same rights. And of course, once you do that, because they work together as a unit or as a group within a group, you put everybody else at a disadvantage because we've all been taught to be individuals and not to work together like that.
Another thing is, let's get real for a second there, right? Let's just say these men who landed on them beaches and risked their lives, and many did get killed, if they were told that today, you know, we'd be teaching the grandchildren, you know, how to be transgender, you know, turning all these countries with African immigrants, all these countries, even that won World War II, are now being, you know, outnumbered by these, or in a number of years will be outnumbered by these immigrants. I'm just wondering how many would get off the boat.
One of the main things they told them was that, you know, they were fighting for democracy and freedom of speech and freedom of conscience. And look at the way freedom of speech has been destroyed today. Well, under hate speech laws.
I saw a veteran talking about that we fought for the freedom we have today. And I thought, well, little does this guy know.
Well, what freedom does he mean? Freedoms for homosexuals? Freedoms for race mixing?
He's had a long life and he's probably lived through a number of years which he regards as freedom. But be quite honest, the reason I believe that things are starting to happen now was so that people couldn't put World War II and connect the two. You know, it's nearly 100 years now, isn't it, since World War II. So, you know, people won't automatically think of that war as the deciding war, where really it was. And they've took the time, they've gone nice and slow, they've changed. Europe's a totally different place today as it was back then. But it didn't really affect the individuals till recently. I didn't feel anyway, certainly as a population. So now when they're bringing all this LGBT whatever into schools and teaching children at 5 how to have anal sex, you know, suddenly it's starting to affect everybody. And, you know, there was a school in Birmingham today. Protesters have been protesting for a while now. The courts have overruled them and they can only protest now 3 streets away from the school. So, you know, the law's coming into play as well. So we're now looking at a world that if you'd have shown these men back in America and Canada and in Britain in a, you know, some kind of magic ball, crystal ball, I'm sure they would have just thrown down the rifles.
Well, what we're seeing now is the end result of it, aren't we? The end result of human rights and equality law. And they put it all in place back then at the end of the war. And then basically they started funding these minority groups and saying, well, these laws are for you. These are for you so that you can use these. And then they used those minority groups to break down the culture and break down the morals. But they couldn't have done it back then, as you say, because the morality was still so strong. And they had to tell them that they needed to go to war against Germany because Germany was anti-Christian. They told them Germany was doing away with the churches and instigating a new
Hitler
religion.
Was going to be proclaimed as God.
Yeah, Hitler was going to be the new Messiah. I mean, all absolute nonsense. But how are the rest of the people in Europe, and especially in America, how are they supposed to find out the truth about that?
No internet.
No RT giving them, you know, a different view of the news. All they had was the mainstream newspapers and the people who they trusted. I mean, because we've always trusted people in authority because we've always thought, well, that's how they get to be in authority is because they're very, very bright people. They deserve to be there or they wouldn't be there. It's only now that all that is falling apart and people are realizing that, you know, these people are actually in authority because we've been lied to. Because the media is controlled by these banks. We're realizing who it is that controls everything. And that was at the root of this war as well. I mean, if they'd said, well, Germany has come up with a new banking system that has done away with the middleman, people wouldn't have wanted to go to war for that. You know, if they'd been told, well, Germany got rid of the gold standard So we can't have other countries doing the same. So we've got to get rid of them for that reason. Then nobody would have gone to war.
No, exactly. Well, that's why they didn't say it, isn't it? What makes it worse, though, is after the war, you then have the cementing of these lies with Hollywood, because Hollywood then will then make movies based on these lies. People will go along and see them and accept they've heard about it. Now they're watching it in action. And so that's cemented now for another generation. They certainly knew what they were doing.
Well, yeah, particularly with the Holocaust and with the gas chambers and with all these myths that were basically just gossip at the end of the war that they solidified with the Nuremberg trials, and then they left it 10, 20 years until a lot of people were no longer here, and then they started making the movies about it, the Holocaust movies. And that's what really put that, that fantasy image in people's minds of these evil Germans that did these nasty, horrible things. And it's all just to prevent people from looking to find out, well, just what did the Germans actually do? Because they can't have all gone mad. I mean, the story is Adolf Hitler, he just went mad and everybody followed him. And, you know, that can't be true. Yeah. He must have had really good policies, because otherwise Germany would have turned against him. Because the whole world went to war against him.
Exactly.
The story they all went mad, or they were all propagandized, it just doesn't make any sense. So the only way that they can cover that up is to just have, you know, all the time have this anti-Adolf Hitler, anti-National Socialism, pro-gas chambers propaganda. It's got to be in everything. It's got to be in Theresa May's resignation speech. It's got to be in a big Holocaust idol outside the Houses of Parliament. It's got to be on BBC Breakfast in the morning when they interview the latest Holocaust fiction writer. You know, every day it's got to be on the television. The children have got to have mandatory Holocaust education lessons. That's the only way that they can get away with it, is just having it everywhere. So, and then when anybody speaks up against it, everybody's really shocked, because they've never heard anybody doubt the story before. You try talking to someone saying, well, you know, I'm not so sure that there were gas chambers. You know, if they're not people that are sort of nationalist-minded in the first place, I mean, their jaws will drop to the floor, because they will never have heard anybody doubt it before. And they won't understand why either. They will say, but what about all the evidence? Surely you can't believe that.
Well, the thing is that people surely must be thinking by now, why is it still apply? Because it has been nearly 100 years, you know, and how long is it going to go on for? I mean, this is like, you know, is it 200, 300 years where this is still going to be brought to the fore, whereas most wars are just forgotten after, you know, maybe a couple of decades at most.
75 years, isn't it? 75 years, and they're doubling down now, and there's more memorials and museums and all that sort of thing being done now than there ever was before. And the excuse they use is, the excuse they use is, oh, it's fading in people's memory, so we have to remind people of it. But of course, there's less and less people around now that were actually around at the time that can say anything different.
True.
And they can point out that this didn't happen. I think, you know, another side of this as well, I mean, we don't like to think badly of our own defensive forces. I mean, you think of the Tommies that fought in the war. I mean, they're all 100% white. Yeah. They're all 100% British. You know, there are our grandfathers, you know, our great-grandfathers that fought in that war. And we want to be patriotic. And yet at the same time, we know that they went to war for the wrong thing, for the wrong issue. So you feel bad about it. And then you get other people that don't know the truth about it, that think that you're being somehow disloyal or traitorous to your country by saying these things. But you have to hold to the truth, I think. That's more important than anything else. And, you know, accept the fact that we did the wrong thing.
Yeah, it wasn't their fault. I mean, there was hoodwinked. I mean, certainly there were some people who could see through it and were put in prison, as you say, but the rest of the country, the mainstream of the country, were hoodwinked, and they genuinely thought they were going to fight a monster. And this particular monster, if they'd have known what was really happening in Europe, they would have certainly thought twice. But, you know, we have a love for communism and other things as well. people shake their head why we sided with the Bolsheviks. And one thing when I heard the other day on TV, which hit me, was somebody said our main allies were the Americans. Well, you know, there's no main ally. I mean, who's ever fighting with you is an ally. And so the Soviet Union has never mentioned that in that tone. You know, they kind of condemned Stalin and Hitler as two megalomaniacs and let the world just believe that. Whereas, you know, there was no main ally. The Bolsheviks was an ally. The Americans were fooled into being an ally, as were the Canadians and the British.
The Americans didn't come into the war until, you know, right near the end either. They were helping Britain out while pretending to be neutral.
Of course they were, yeah.
But they didn't come into it. But I have noticed one of the things they try to push now is, like, they don't like people to remember that we were on the side with Russia. They would try and say, say Stalin and Hitler were the same. These two megalomaniac dictators that wanted to rule the world. And they forget that Hitler went to war against Stalin.
Yeah, exactly. Well, then again, that's hidden as well when they say that, you know, that he invaded, he brought the peace pact with Russia, you know, by invading the Soviet Union. They never mentioned the fact that Stalin was going to invade. And somebody pulled me up on this on the other week, didn't they? And even Brezhnev in the 70s admitted that Stalin was going, and all Eastern Europe know that Stalin was going to go. But it's denied from us because that would make Hitler a hero because he actually saved that first wave would have been, you know, an unsuspecting Europe with no armies, totally annihilated by Bolsheviks.
Now, Western Europe only remained free, to say, if you can call it that word, not underneath the communists, because of Hitler preempting Stalin's invasion.
Exactly.
That really,
we're not taught.
Yeah, but you should be able to work that out logically. When you think,
we should be able to capture millions on the border.
Yeah, when you think of what happened to the Poland and the Baltic countries and all the other Hungary and all these other countries after the war, and Croatia that were just sort of handed over to the communists that they took over. Exactly. And you think, well, how come that didn't happen to the West then? Well, it's because they were prevented from getting that far.
That's right.
And we've also got, the Russian celebrations of this. And, they have this huge thing that they have on Red Square, their Victory Day. Like, they have a massive parade. And it's a huge part of the myth of Russia, the national myth, is fighting this patriotic war. Germany just suddenly invaded Russia and all of Russia's menfolk went out there heroically to fight against this invading force. And again, you know, probably a lot of these Russians were good people, just like the British.
Exactly. But
that wasn't what happened.
Yeah.
And then you think, well, also this celebration they have, this Victory Day thing, I thought they had actually done that every year since the war, but they didn't. That came about after the fall of the Iron Curtain. That's only come about in the last 20 years, that big march that they do.
Really?
And I think because it's helped to bring the country together as patriots, and that's where this myth has come from, that, this great Soviet or this great Russian army, you know, defeated the Germans that were trying to invade them,
fascists,
and they all pulled together to defeat the fascists. Yeah, that's it. And that helps them to, you know, all feel as one and all feel together and have these feelings of patriotism and bringing Russia together as the Russian people after the fall of the Soviet Union. But of course, which is good, but the flip side of it is that it's based on something that isn't true. You know, and if Hitler had succeeded in getting all the way to Moscow, you know, Russia would have been the country that was liberated. You know, if France can be liberated by the Allies, by what they did when France was at peace, Germany could have liberated the Russians by getting all the way to Moscow, and we'd be hearing a different story.
I think it confused things after the war because Stalin turned. I mean, I do believe that Stalin was controlled by the bankers, due to Lenin winning the revolution, and he was being funded by the bankers. And if you fund, I think Milner was one as well, I believe, Lloyd Milner put quite a lot of money into that revolution. And so the bankers actually control the Soviet Union. And I'm convinced all the massacres in Poland, Stalin was told to do anyway. And in fact, he was the man to do it. I mean, he was the ideal mass killer, if you like. So a lot of the blame does fall on the bankers, but it's gone hidden because they view Stalin as a cover. And when Stalin did turn, for whatever reason, after the war was won, that threw a lot of things up in the air. So until he was poisoned and things were back on an even keel again, where they controlled the Soviet Union again, then they could carry on with their lies.
Well, a lot of the communists were robbers anyway. They were bank robbers anyway. They were criminals, cutthroat lot, and yet they were in the pay of the American bankers. I mean, that really shows you that, you know, whether they're wearing a suit or tie or not, you know, really they're all robbers. Whether they're the guys at the top running the banks or whether it's the people doing their dirty work for them, they're all cutthroat criminals. You think what some of these Soviets did, you know, when they would come into a town, they would get all the women, they would kill the people that owned the rich townhouse, and then they'd just get all the women in there and they'd rape them and they'd kill them. And they'd say to people that joined the Bolsheviks, well, you can have your fill of these women as well. And we'll give you a pass. You can have whatever woman you want.
I saw some photographs the other day, actually, of a line of German women crucified by the Bolsheviks. I mean, they used to nail them crucified to barn doors as well, but this was specifically on crosses, like something out of the scene of Spartacus, naked women hanging on crosses.
I'm just trying to think which one of the modern politicians was related to some of these people that were involved in that. It might have been Nick Clegg's wife, someone from her family, or Vince Cable. It's someone to do with the Liberal Democrats. And one of their relatives was involved with that Yagoda guy from the NKVD, you know, the world's biggest mass killer, and he was working for him. His descendants, you know, they're in the British government or married to Nick Clegg, it might have been. Sure, I remember reading about it in the Daily Mail. Nothing's been done to get these communist criminals. Nobody's gone after them after the war.
Well, they can't. The law's in there. They put the law in there. Saying that only Germans committed war crimes.
Yeah, that was the law that came out in the 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it protected the ones leaving the Soviet Union then. As it fell, obviously people like, you know, Chelsea's chairman, one or two others, billionaires, you know, they were all protected.
But what about these crimes that didn't happen during the war? I mean, that just happened during Soviet times. These show trials, these people that were executed and sent to the gulags, and yet everything that happened to the Ukrainians in the Holodomor.
Well, it's all been swept under the carpet, hasn't it? Because, again, they would have been controlled by the bankers.
Because they can't. I mean, they can't say, "Well, that's war crimes, and only Germans can commit war crimes," because these crimes happen outside of the war.
What's in particular really strikes me as bad is the way that Roosevelt sold Stalin to the Americans. He knew what went on in the Holodomor and what Stalin had been doing, and even previous to what Lenin had been doing. But he sold Stalin as Uncle Joe to the Americans, just so we could get him into the League of Nations. And that in itself should be a red flag to anybody in America who doubts that Roosevelt was not a war criminal himself.
He was Jewish as well, wasn't he? So I hear. Came from New Amsterdam.
Of Dutch descent.
Yeah, in New Amsterdam and the people that were there at the time, it was all Jews. And you think of his name as well. And the administration.
Besides an hour, there's a few, wasn't there?
And the administration was full of them. I mean, Henry Ford exposed a lot of these Jews at the time in the First World War, leading up to the Second World War, that were controlling the American administration. So when the war broke out, you know, America may have on the surface it may have looked neutral, but in the background was doing all that she could to help Britain and go against Germany.
Patton saw it as well, didn't he? Remember?
And he was executed, wasn't he, or assassinated?
No, he was assassinated, yeah.
I'm just trying to think.
There's been a lot of things going on.
Well, there was a British guy. I think he was assassinated as well. I can't think of his name. Lawrence of Arabia, something like that.
Decapitated.
He was assassinated, and we had the king. They didn't want the king on the throne in Britain because he was sympathetic to Germany.
Divorce is an excuse.
So they brought in a divorced woman that he fell in love with, and of course, if he wanted to marry the divorced woman, he had to step down and abdicate, and that's what had to happen back then. And then
if he'd stayed, then he would have been controlled anyway. I think he must have known that. And I don't think he wanted to be.
Well, he was sympathetic, wasn't he, to Adolf Hitler and nationalism. And
the
working class. And he took an interest in that. And then you compare, you know, how noble he was and how he said, well, I will step down because I love this woman. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Prince Harry, who the thought doesn't even cross his mind that he shouldn't be marrying somebody who's divorced. And obviously it didn't cross his mind he shouldn't be marrying someone who's of a different race. But the fact that she's divorced, and we already have this precedent from less than 100 years ago where the king had to step down because it would have been such a disgrace to do that. And Harry could say today, well, you know, marrying somebody who is divorced, it's not such a big disgrace anymore, is it? But think of the insult it is to his ancestor for him to just stay there as the prince and marry someone who's divorced. I mean, what an insult when his, you know, his ancestor had to step down rather than do that.
Yeah, funnily enough, she's attacked Trump as well. She said some nasty things about Trump, I believe, so... But Trump was kind of brushing it off last night. But, you know, it can't be good because I think there's a reason why there's really one royal family which owns three quarters of the planet. And that's because they're in league with our friends.
Yeah, but as you say, Dennis, when she has to go to the City of London, she's got to go there as a commoner, isn't she? She has to ask permission.
Yeah,
she's got to walk there behind him and all these protocols. She's not there as you know, the woman that's in charge. She's there as the woman that does as she's told.
Big red flag.
She's just, I do think she's just a titular head, basically. She just does what she's told.
I think so, yeah. And you know, there's a lot of propaganda goes out to keep them to the level that people believe in them. But certainly, you know, that they weren't covered in glory with the Diana affair and one or two other things in the past. But they're protected by the press again, and, you know, people don't really look past end of the road, do they?
I think you can go back to the killing of the king, Charles I, I think it was, the one that they beheaded. And I think ever since then, you know, they've been, well... You better not, you know, upset things too much. Otherwise, it'll be off with your head. So, you know, and ever since then, I think they thought, well, we're not going to put our necks on the line because, you know, you beheaded one of us. Whereas up until that point,
well, you know, they look at the alternative, and you know, I'm not convinced that Charles has paid much tax in his lifetime, but certainly owns all of Cornwall and quite a bit of land elsewhere. She owns a lot of land all over the world. And if they do and say the right things, then no doubt they'll live out their lives. But, you know, for anybody who can look at a London audience from 1945 and see the changes of a London audience that she'd give a speech to today and not say anything speaks volumes.
When you think about it, you know, these kings, they used to lead us into battle. They used to be at the front. You know, they were taking the risk along with everybody else. They used to be the champion of the poor. You could petition to see the king. If there was anything wrong, you could go and see the king, have a direct route to him. And he was the subject's voice. He'd have all the nobles, he'd have the rich people around him, and, you know, they'd be trying to get what they could out of the peasants. And he was the voice for the peasants because, you know, he was the king. He didn't need to make lots of money. He was always going to be king. So he's obviously not going to sell off his country and his subjects he looked on as his possessions. Why would he mistreat his own possessions? And he was ahead. And they, especially kings like Alfred the Great, you know, they used to see themselves as God's envoy on earth. It was their role to set a good example to everyone else and to ensure that the people were educated and well looked after. And the idea of doing badly by your subjects, selling them out or selling parts of your country off or allowing foreigners in to run the banks, you know, that would have just seemed as impossible to them as gay marriage. You know, it just wouldn't have been possible to comprehend. And that's what royalty used to be like. So when we come to the time when the royals are all corrupted, we've got nobody can fulfill that role anymore, you need drastic changes, which is what National Socialism and fascism wants. So I think that was given the actual ability of the king, giving that power back to one man, somebody that rose up from the people. And, you know, Hitler was an effective king. Mussolini was effectively a king, even though they didn't come from that bloodline. And when you add the bloodline to it, then you've got eugenics, and you can say, well, whoever was king in the first place, they must have had a very, very high IQ. They must have been very, very physically fit because they led people into battle. Mm-hmm. So that their children are also going to be like that. You know, and they're going to marry the most beautiful woman, the most intelligent woman as well. So you're going to have, you know, the fittest type of human being to represent you as king, the best person that can be given all this education that you will get when you're a royal. So they didn't have that bit, but so that's one bit that we can't have anymore. But I do believe that we do get people that rise up from among the ranks of the people that you know, are destined to do great things. You know.
What I say to people that, you know, who've got any doubts, is just look at Europe at the the end of the war, and how much it's changed to today. Has it changed for the better? You know, and I'm quite sure a lot of people with high morals will certainly say no, it hasn't changed for the better.
Well, they think they were fighting to get people's freedoms and freedom of speech, and they'll still say it today. And a lot of people don't really realize it, you know, how little freedoms we still have, how we can't criticize certain religions, we can't criticize perversity, we can't criticize banks even, we can't even say anything now.
But we can criticize Christianity.
We can't even say anything now if a Jew doesn't like it, he suddenly becomes a so-called victim.
Hate speech.
And can say that he's the victim. It only takes one. You know, as E. Michael Jones says, it was only one Jew that went to the Crown Prosecution Service and said, Jez Turner's speech was victimizing me. And it was that Gideon Falter from the campaign against anti-Semitism. And they're trying to do the same thing in Florida as well. So that if a Jew is offended by somebody, he can then go and say, I'm offended at this, I'm a victim. It's a hate crime, and get people prosecuted. People don't realize it. They think when they hear about anti-Semitism, it means violence against Jews or violence against buildings. When they hear Islamophobia, they think, oh, it means somebody pulling, you know, somebody's burqa off or hitting.
Like burning a mosque or something. Yeah,
burning a mosque. They always think it's to do with violence. They don't realize that it's just simple criticism. It's just, you know, talking about subjects that we're no longer supposed to talk about. And all of this comes
like
about
said,
from
Christianity
the war.
Can be criticized and Jesus can be made fun of. You know, there was a case of the life of Brian when John Cleese was whinging not long back on a YouTube video saying he's going to move to the Bahamas because he's fed up of England and England is not the England it used to be. And he was part of that system, you know, where they were mocking Christ in that film. And it's, you know, he still can't see it.
What they're really celebrating with that D-Day is Christianity losing that war.
You know,
As you made that point so many times, it was a holy war, and it was Christianity fighting against, you know, all these forces of darkness that have been amassing since the Enlightenment, since humanism, since the French Revolution. And it was all the people was coming together to try and shrug that off. And unfortunately, they lost. But, you know, we can still find that out. The truth about that is still out there, and we'll keep talking about it. There's no chance of that ever stopping. So thank you very much for coming on today, Dennis.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Interesting subject.
Great stuff. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend.
Radio Aryan.